I need a noun.
Thing. It's the best noun. You can use it in a lot of circumstances. I have only the best nouns.
These are not the best nouns you've ever come up with, I'm going to say. Welcome to Maximize This, the only podcast with two hosts who can't even agree what day it is. What day do you think it is right now?
It's October 9th, 2016. It's Sunday.
That is incorrect. It is Saturday, October 8th.
That is not true. Today we're going to talk about why Dinah hates markets.
I'm really curious about this. I've been looking forward to this one for a long time.
Me too.
Because I'm really curious.
But before we do that, do you know where I was in the past week and a half?
Vaguely. You've been prancing around Europe.
Kind of. So Saturday I was in Boston. I took a bus to New York, did a job interview, flew to London all that same day. Then I was in London for 4 days, and then just 2 days ago, I got to Lithuania, where I am now with 30 of my American-Lithuanian relatives for a week-and-a-half-long tour around the country. We have our own bus. I will post a photo, maybe.
That is incredible. I've got to see this bus.
Today, we are going... right now, I'm in the capital of Lithuania, Vilnius, people like to say, because they don't say it right. And we're going to the island castle today and also the geographic center of Europe, which is in Lithuania, according to the French. So it's not even like us saying so.
The geographic center of Europe is in Lithuania. This is counting like if you extend all the way up to like the Scandinavian countries and include the
European part of Russia.
Yeah.
Because, well, the land masses, because that is all part of Europe. So, of course, you include it.
Hmm. What is the dividing line between Europe and Asia?
The Ural Mountains.
Hmm.
I'm going to make a list of facts I know that Todd doesn't know. And it's a very small countable number of things each time we talk.
No, are you kidding? It's going to be an enormous list. You could make an entire podcast about that. I don't think I'd subscribe, though.
So, markets. I hate markets, but what does that mean? I kind of like farmers markets. And when I'm in a developing country, I like going to their markets and buying stuff. So,
yeah, I think for the sake of discussion, we should define what we mean by markets for this. So Dinah hates markets. Which markets are we talking about?
I think of them as there are financial markets, which include primary capital. So like when a small startup needs venture capital funding in order to grow, for instance, that's a capital market. Secondary capital markets, which are the stock markets, bonds, futures, currency exchanges, money markets. Those are all financial, mm-hmm. right? Would you agree with that category?
I agree that those are all financial markets. Yep.
Okay. I'm going to call a second market goods you buy every day, market-based pricing and production quantities for goods and services. So for instance, Venezuela would probably not count in having that kind of market because they fix their prices in a lot of cases.
So you're talking about like goods and services kind of, but more like day-to-day personal consumer kind of products.
Or also for companies, yeah.
Okay.
But when people say the U.S. is capitalist market, it refers to both financial and this goods and services market.
Sure. We're trying to separate sort of things that people or companies use on a day-to-day basis versus the sort of paper assets kind of things like financial instruments like stocks, bonds, those kinds of things.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You can think of it as an auction system where you have a supply and demand and there's sort of an equilibrium that the price and quantity come to based on how many people want to buy a certain product. That's generally what people think of.
Sure.
And that's the broad definition of a market system.
Yep. You have both consumers and producers that change their levels of consumption and production based on this sort of macroeconomic 101 supply and demand kind of behavior.
I'll later bring up the fact that I don't believe... So there's two parts of my objections. One, that I just hate some attributes of markets, but two, that I disagree with a lot of how they model and describe what markets are. So there are some economists, kind of heterodox economists on the fringe, quote unquote, that believe, for instance, there isn't actually an equilibrium because of the time-based element for things to adjust. They never actually reach an equilibrium. So that model is quite inaccurate, according to some, which I'll bring up later. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the traditional perspective is that markets reach some kind of equilibrium. And ideally, it's an efficient equilibrium. Like that's one of the ways that you measure whether a market is working well or not, is whether it's providing an efficient allocation of resources based on the signals that are being sent by the producers and consumers in that market. So that's sort of the traditional view. And I think, like you said, the heterodox view is that such equilibriums do not exist or there are multiple equilibriums that can exist.
Right.
So continuing on, so in the traditional view that economists usually take with markets, there are certain factors that need to be in place in order for markets to have a high probability of reaching that efficient equilibrium, that efficient allocation of resources. When those conditions aren't met, you can have market failures that arise from a variety of reasons. And so some of the traditional ones are structural problems. If you have a monopoly or a monopsony, places where there's only one seller or one buyer of a product, that reduces competition and can lead to inefficient pricing. Would you agree?
Yes.
Okay. Exchange problems, anytime there's high transaction costs or informational asymmetries, the buyer or the seller knows a lot more about the product than the other person, that can cause problems with the exchange, making it more difficult to enact trades that are either in quantity or in quality representative of the value of the product being exchanged.
Yes, and in informational asymmetries, I would add when different buyers or different sellers also don't have the same information.
Yep.
Or transaction costs, certain buyers will have more difficulty to get to the market because they live further away.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't have access to the internet, so they don't know the accurate prices.
Exactly. You can have things about the good itself being traded that make it difficult to have a fully functioning market, either with public goods, things that you can't really control who takes advantage of the good or not, or something like externalities.
Can you define externalities for
us? Oh, sure.
Us?
An externality is let me see what the best way is to say this. It's a side effect of production that has consequences for people not involved in the market itself.
So for instance, it can produce other products or harm other products, but the cost of that production or harm is incurred in the other products rather than in the product that's producing that harm.
Exactly. And it's usually borne by people not involved in the transaction at all. So people who otherwise wouldn't care about the transactions going on all of a sudden care because they are affected by the externalities of that transaction. So an example of an externality would be a steel factory whose costs only account for the production of the steel, but not for the pollution that the creation of the steel causes. And so society ends up bearing that cost. And so it's not an accurate reflection of the price of the product.
When you talked about the good itself,
mm-hmm.
like public goods itself is just something that affects everybody. So like water, air, it is maybe a subset of externality because a lot of decisions you may make, like you said, buying steel is going to have an effect on the environment, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But either you're not aware of it or it feels like such a tiny, tiny, tiny marginal effect that to you the cost is zero because it's so close to zero.
I was going to say a public good is usually characterized by it's not exclusive, more than one person can be enjoying the good at the same time. And it's also not enforceable. You can't really prevent people who want to use the good from using the good.
I think that's a good definition. So then you had one more.
The last item I have that can cause market failure would be, this is sort of a squishy category, but I'm going to say moral issues. And this is something where there's theoretically no reason why you couldn't have a market for these things, but there are moral objections to it. And this would come under things like organ donation. We don't allow that kind of activity to take place. We don't allow a market for that to occur. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's definitely a moral issue when we think about how do we have optimal markets. And I was thinking more on the opposite side, which is there are things that would be morally good that don't actually get markets created. And in fact, that would be often it's the public goods types of items that are the reason those aren't created. And then, like you said, there are markets that are immoral that are not created for the reason that you said. And then third, there are markets that are immoral that are created that the free market, you might say, may tend to an equilibrium or may be efficient, but society may not want them.
Right.
Now that, I guess, gets into the criticism of it, but I'd say there's a moral issue in a variety of positive and negative effects.
Yeah. And I think we'll probably get into later, but even when there are these moral prohibitions against some of these markets, much like from Jurassic Park, life finds a way, you'll still find black markets for goods that should not be traded in. They still are. I mean, you still can find places in the world where organs can be purchased. So that's one of the problems with markets that I think we'll get into later is that they're very difficult to prevent from springing up where you don't want them.
All right. I agreed. I had two more causes of market failure. One of them is power imbalance. This is in part a consequence of some of these exchange issues, the transaction costs or information asymmetries. So if you have a banker who has access to a lot of information and has financial backing to dig up reports and pay for them, they're going to know a lot more than you and me who want to buy Microsoft and mm-hmm. know what we can, but still don't know as much as they do. Also, you have huge institutions that can kind of sway the market and can decide to drive it up or down because they have a lot of concentration of money.
Yeah, it's sort of a combination of some of the flavors of market structure and also information asymmetry. It's like to the point where you have so much information and so much power in the market that you're able to manipulate it in ways that other players cannot.
So the last one I would add, that's actually the first one and maybe only one that I think is really important, is irrationality. Markets, market equilibrium, really, and economics, until the last couple of decades, has always assumed that people will maximize their personal utility when they make decisions, and that the equilibrium will reflect people's relative desires, and that there's no irrationality involved. But it's completely untrue. Behavioral economics is starting to try to prove these things, but still so slow in just showing tiny behaviors that are irrational and adding each tiny one into the model and slowly growing it.
I sort of agree with you, and we can, I don't want to split hairs over it. You can argue that some of that irrationality does get priced into the, like, if you think of a market as a transmitter of information, value information, I mean, it does transmit the value that the person at the time placed on that good, whether on reflection they would make the same decision again, who knows.
But that's been proven to be false. For instance, if you're walking downtown with a friend, some days you're going to feel like running into that store and shopping and buying that shirt. And other days you're just going to have no mood for shopping.
Mm-hmm.
The utility hasn't really changed day to day, but your mental state has.
Yeah.
If it was a repeatable irrationality, then sure, the market equilibrium could price it in. But the first problem is it's not necessarily repeatable. It's subject to emotional states and other things that fluctuate and are hard to measure.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that these basic axioms of economics that say, you know, let's break it down into simple utility curves of one product or a couple of products, and then extrapolate that to an entire market to a lot of products. That extrapolation assumes basic, like, additive properties. Prospect theory and other examples in behavioral economics show that's not true. You can't just say, because I like product A and here's my utility curve, and I also like product B and there's my utility curve, that when you bring all those together, that my utility curve will just add.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. So that doesn't even hold. But so markets break down when you have human players, basically,
yep.
Which is every market. And final point on market breakdowns, actually, development economics is a very fascinating way to learn more about it, because that is a perfect example where a lot of these problems are exaggerated. Markets are not perfectly working yet because some of these problems haven't been solved. So it's actually a very interesting field of economics to look at.
I gotta imagine, yeah, that's gotta be fascinating to study as those come online.
Yeah.
So let's summarize what we've got so far. So we've got categories of markets that we're talking about, sort of financial markets, consumer and company goods.
And we also talked about the market breakdowns can be structural. They can be about the exchange and transaction costs. It can be something about the good. It could be because of the public good, other externalities like pollution, moral issues, power imbalances, and the most important, in my opinion, irrationality.
Mm-hmm.
And if those things line up well and you don't have those issues, then an efficient market, I would say, is characterized by the fact that people have the ability to pick what they want, that they generally make the choices that are in their best interest, that reflect their utility, that prices and quantities adjust quickly. You don't have sticky prices.
Mm-hmm.
And that it tends to a what I will call fair equilibrium. People are basically distributing their resources in the most efficient way, which implies that the overall equilibrium is the quote-unquote best value for society as a whole. And I think Republicans and Democrats debate whether the equilibrium you get from markets is actually fair or not, and whether fair should even be a term when you talk about efficiency of the market. But I would say there's some sort of fairness built in, that why use a market system if it's going to severely disadvantage a set of people systematically all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea is that everybody would end up pretty good.
I think we'll probably get into it later if we talk about alternatives to markets, but markets being a very organic thing that sort of arise on their own without a whole lot of assistance needed from other sources, it's difficult oftentimes to set up alternatives to them.
So let's get a little more specific here, and I think we can focus on financial markets and some of the things that you and I may both agree that are undesirable, or maybe I'll be alone in these hates.
I'm curious either way.
All right, I'm just going to bring this one up first because it's relevant. Because when I was in London, on Sunday, I pulled out some pounds from the ATM, and I remember paying $1.40, maybe $1.38 for the pound. Now, when you and I visited Great Britain in the past, it was like $1.60, it peaked up at $1.80, and this was in the last, say, 15 years. This was really low because, as you know, when Brexit was announced in June, the pound fell about 10% against the dollar. Mm-hmm. And now it's even a little bit lower at $1.40. So on Sunday, I pulled it out at $1.40. Now, unbeknownst to me, there was a big announcement by the head of one of the parties saying in March of 2017, for certain, they are going to enact the clause that starts the 2-year process for Brexit.
The Article 50.
Yes.
Yeah.
When that announcement happened, the pound fell even more. So when I was leaving on Thursday, I was selling back about 20 pounds back to my friend. He gave me back $24. $24?
So what is that, like 120?
I don't know if he looked up a slightly wrong number, but then I checked and it had dipped to a 31-year low. 31-year low of 124 within 4 days. Now, this is important. And the exchange rate is in part a measure of people's feelings. Feelings, okay? Emotional, irrational feelings about, partly based on fact and data as much as they can assess, but still their sentiment of how strong the economy of Britain will be for the coming years.
It's a measure of confidence. In some respects.
Yes, it is. Which confidence you'd say is an emotion, right?
I mean, I think you can apply some quantitativeness to it. But yes, at some point, there's probably some gut feel that goes into it as well.
Right. So data-based emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Then I read an article that describes that because it fell to 124, the outcome of the British economy is looking meek. But part of it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. As Britain's exchange rate drops, what happens? As a company's currency drops, their buying power goes down. And depending if you're an export or import country and a lot of different dynamics, it can negatively impact your economy. So because people thought Brexit would be bad for the UK, it dropped the exchange rate, which made it structurally bad for the future of the UK. Do you see the problem here? People's emotions caused damage to the economy.
Well, only in as much as whether their initial assessments of whether Brexit was bad for the country or not were accurate or not.
Right.
So if people's assessments of the impact of Brexit to the United Kingdom's economy were accurate, then the market is just responding to an increased probability that those bad outcomes will come to pass.
So that's the rational economist explanation of what's going on.
Yes.
And that may very well be true. It also could be that people react emotionally and nobody actually knows what's going to happen to the future of Britain with Brexit. It seems that because now you're going to potentially have taxes on imports and exports and higher transaction costs and those things that may or may not come with the negotiating deals, because we have no idea what will come with the negotiated deals.
Mm-hmm.
But then this reaction to it makes it even more likely that they're going to have a struggle.
Yeah.
So in the category of things I hate about financial markets, one is that the way that they are structured can cause crises. The 2007 financial crisis, which we're all aware of, was in fact caused by the fact that the infrastructure of the financial system is kind of wonky. And that there was a lot of speculated betting by banks on how certain markets would do. I just hate that. Is that awful? There could be better systems that are not so vulnerable, structurally vulnerable to people's emotions. And I finally found an economist who my dad has been pushing on me actually for quite some time, who agrees with this point, wrote a book about it. It's called Debunking Economics. He's an Australian named Stephen Keen that now lives in London, and I will probably call him up and see if I can work with him.
Nice.
And outlines why the way that economists currently view the world led to being blind to these kinds of structural issues with the financial markets and the financial system. It leads to a second problem I have with financial markets, which is, I don't know if you're aware of this definition, but the value of a stock is supposed to be a mathematical calculation of the reflection of the expected profitability of a company over its lifetime. So all of the profits it's going to have every year, discounted by a quote-unquote risk-free discount rate, which think of as inflation and an expected amount that they would that a risk-free investment would get.
Right.
Usually that's like the index.
Right.
Discounted by that, summed up all the profits that you'd expect the company to create. But day to day, stocks fluctuate like crazy because people don't actually know how much a company can make. They make models, and models are often inaccurate and very difficult to assess. I've done many models. And, you know, usually what happens during a merger and acquisition is the boss decides, here's kind of what the target price would probably be in order for us to sell successfully our company to this buyer, or vice versa. And okay, analysts, go figure out a model, a way in which this future world could exist in order to justify that price. And they come back and they're like, well, here's the price, that the best price we could actually come up with. It's really far from your number. The boss yells at them and says, no, go back and make it better. Change other variables. Come up with other assumptions. So they have to come up with crazy assumptions that aren't realistic, that justify the valuation of the company. So the models that analysts create of the future value of a company are just vastly vary and are vastly assumption-based. So if stock market can only be driven by, again, emotion.
But that's sort of the goal of the market, is to provide a place for people to exchange their valuations of what the stock is worth. And you get a very accurate idea of what people think the stock is worth from the market, whether it's accurate whether it's accurately reflects what the true value of the stock is. I mean, we could have a discussion about whether a true value of a stock even exists to begin with.
So this is the point. If there were the ability to create models that were more accurate, then you could have a true value of the stock. And it's impossible. Obviously, there's too many variables and too many things that change over time. So you're right. It can't reflect the true value. It does reflect generally what people think. Sometimes it reflects the fact that people are riding a wave and are just hoping that the stock will keep going up. And it's not actually a reflection of what people think about that profitability. It's just that people are hoping it will keep going up because they want to make money off of it. And in that case, it's not even a reflection of what people think. It's a reflection of betting. So secondary capital markets, stock market, for instance, is really a betting game. And I don't think that you should be able to make money off of something that's intended to just reflect people's perceptions. It skews the market. And then it's also subject to herd mentality, and it causes bubbles, which cause crises.
I mean, within this system, though, I mean, couldn't one say that the people who are purely motivated by emotional reactions will be making less informed or less educated decisions about when to buy and sell a stock, and more savvy people can take advantage of that? Like, sort of bring those things back into that equilibrium that we're looking for from the market?
Well, it is true what you just said, that the people that are in the institutions and have more knowledge will then make more educated decisions. However, that's now driving to the power imbalance that we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to correct the irrationality, you can leverage the power imbalance in which they now have the power to skew the market up and down for financial gain again.
Sure.
And it will not accurately reflect what we actually think the value of that stock is. It will reflect the fact that those investors currently know that they can take advantage of a certain momentum swing and certain fear of other investors and make money off of it. Now, maybe the long-term trend does have some rough correlation to the value expectations, and I will give you that. But one of the main things I tend to get upset about in life is misrepresentation of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the financial markets do that all the time. And it's really a sophisticated betting market.
Yeah.
It's not. You should not be able to make money off of this.
I completely agree that the day-to-day fluctuations of the stock market are a terrible, terrible indicator of the value of an individual company or the stock market as a whole. I mean, I can say sort of from a personal investing perspective, I mean, I choose to steer clear of that whole thing. And just if you're in the stock market for the long term, right, like the stock market has historically provided pretty decent returns over the, you know, the history of the Dow Jones or the S&P. And so, you know, by just taking a blanket investment through a, you know, an index fund or something like that, you can step away from all of the day-to-day turmoil of the market and just sort of ride the general, increase in the value of things over time. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is no one's forcing anybody to jump into that shark tank of people and engage in trading. Like, the people who are doing that trading seem to think that they know what they're doing. And if they do, great. And if they don't, well, there's people that are going to take advantage of that, but no one's forcing them to.
When I hear the argument, no one's forcing you to X, Y, Z, it usually is it's a fallacy. And for two reasons. First, our entire lives are based on this financial infrastructure. You can't get away from it. So even if you're not investing in stocks, the S&P 500 and everything is integrated into your 401k. It's integrated into what the interest rates end up being in your savings.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to not actually participate. Maybe you're not participating directly. And the second point is, when you say nobody's forcing you to do XYZ, that's sort of an excuse for not looking at the actual system's flaws and trying to fix it.
I'm not saying that there shouldn't be regulations in place. I mean, for example, if we're talking about the 2007 financial crisis, I think there were regulations that clearly could have been put into place that would have prevented or at least mitigated a lot of the damage that was done by the financial institutions in that scenario. So I don't know that that's not a strike against the market as a whole. It's just that there are some regulations that could be put into place to mitigate some of the market failures that arose.
You could say that. Regulations, you could also say, are band-aids that are very difficult to predict, especially the way economists currently model the financial markets. Mm-hmm. And there are blind holes that do not allow them to see things that other people did see coming ahead of time. The financial system is always going to evolve because people can make it money off of it, because they're allowed to make money off of it. People are going to find ways around the current regulations. I mean, it's how the regulatory system always works. First of all, it's always a few steps behind what the financial engineers are doing.
Right. It's always more lucrative to be actually involved in the market than to be trying to regulate the market.
That's the second point, exactly. The best minds tend to go to where the money is. I mean, this is something I took a class from somebody who's worked on all sides and was a senior leader, and he says that one of the big problems with regulations is just that the people there.
Well, no, you don't have to say it. Like, I'm a freshly minted MBA from the Harvard Business School. Do I want to go make $1 million a year at Goldman Sachs, or do I want to go make $80,000 a year working for the
regulatory body?
I mean, yeah, it's a pretty pretty clear cut. So I think I understand why you dislike the financial markets.
Because it can cause crises. You shouldn't be able to make money off of it, because that skews the way things unravel. It is not an actually accurate measure of the underlying fundamentals. It's misrepresented to individual people. It's susceptible to panic and herd thinking. It's educated betting, which just seems, what value does that add to society? Just a money-making machine. And it's susceptible to power imbalance. That's the summary.
Do you want to talk about a solution to this, or are we going to wrap that up at the end?
My solution to this is to continue reading the book by Stephen Keen and see what alternate models are proposed.
Does he have a chapter at the end of the book?
I have to check. It's on my phone. My solution is to create a system in which people can't make money off of a secondary financial market, but still find a way to allow them to provide their information in a way that the market can assimilate what they think. There is no better system yet. That's probably why we haven't gone to it. Let's jump very quickly to the goods and services markets.
Okay.
I hate markets also applies to this to some extent. Now, what's the opposite of a goods and services market? I think the opposite is price fixing and production planning by a central government. And I clearly disagree with that, all right? My family came from communist Soviet Union. In fact, we just went to the KGB Museum last night here in Vilnius. It's really fascinating history. And Venezuela is going downhill, in part because they built up a dependence on oil and overspent on the social sector, and in part because they had this price fixing planned economy. I'm not saying I hate markets. Let's go to that.
That is, in my research, unfortunately, the only alternative that's been tried by any large economy in the world with, as you said, somewhat dubious results.
Yes. I'll start with what I don't like, which is quickly sums up to the points that we had earlier about what can cause markets to fail. I just think they're all over the place, and that the market model that we have in economics is not an actual accurate representation of what happens in our quote unquote free market. So maybe the biggest beef I have with it is that we don't correctly describe it, and that people talk about it almost by lemma, almost by assumption. Some time ago, Adam Smith, the quote-unquote founder of economics, came up with this thought about the invisible hand, that prices will just kind of adjust based on people's selfish voting of supply and demand, of what they want and what they want to sell. Mm-hmm. That was never proven. But because people now just came to assume it and like that model, we now extrapolate and say, therefore, XYZ will happen. But it was never proven. It's not a true science. The counter hypotheses are debunked as pseudoscience. People that are like Stephen Keen and Hyman Minsky, who predicted the crash, were never listened to until, in retrospect, they were right.
I mean, I definitely agree with you that saying Adam Smith invented economics is like saying Newton invented gravity. Like, there were things that existed before Adam Smith came around, right? So, like, you had markets functioning more or less effectively for millennia before Adam Smith came around, right?
Exactly. And that somehow the definition took hold,
yeah,
and became this central theorem, as if there were physics theories to discover.
I mean, I know that economics tries really hard to be quantitative and analytical science, like a hard science. And in a lot of respects, they have been successful. But it's, like you said, it's not physics. There aren't rules of the universe that govern how trades are going to go down or how markets are going to spring up.
Right.
So I agree with you in that respect.
Or if there are, I mean, you could say that a person who knows they're about to lose their job or has the emotional state of thinking they're going to lose their job is more likely to save and put money into a bank, even if interest rates are low and he should be instead investing in a new house. Mm-hmm. Like, clearly, some of those are well predictable, but that takes 100 or 1,000 variables to build into very complex models. And that complexity is very hard to practically do empirically and to prove. So the models tend to be simpler.
I completely agree that the models have to be simplified and that they lose a lot of their predictive power. I mean, I'll just broaden further and say any system that attempts to predict human behavior is destined to fail.
Yeah.
Human beings are not predictable creatures. And whether we're talking about economics or political science or anything like that, you're not going to be able to, with any 100% certainty, predict what people are going to do. You're just going to have your best guess, and humanity will always surprise you.
It's true. And one of the problems with economics is that human behavior also evolves.
Mm.
Here's an example. You have an outcome that's, like I said, systematically biased against certain groups. There are huge problems with food deserts. Chicago is a great example. The African American community specifically does not have access to good food. The average distance to a McDonald's is half the average distance to their nearest grocer in those communities in Chicago. Mm. But all the other ethnic communities, it's the same. So people in those communities systematically have poorer options just because the free market ended up with this scenario. That's an example of a systematically biased outcome because of power imbalances, because of various other market failures. But on the other hand, on the point about human behavior changing, like right now, people are going to therefore spend on McDonald's because it's cheaper. But it could be in 100 years, even in that situation, they would go twice the distance and spend on healthy food, maybe because of different education or different cultural preferences. And that wouldn't even be built into the model today. Because yeah. Things change, unlike physics, where you have a very scientific basis you can prove.
I want to go back to your McDonald's example, because I think it hits at the crux of your dissatisfaction with markets. So the way markets are usually evaluated is on how well they arrive at an efficient distribution of goods or resources among the population. And so that's one way to measure whether a market is efficient or not. There are non-efficiency measures for a market that are not traditional, but are, I think, more in line with what you're talking about. If you look at a situation and you say that a market results in an inequitable distribution, that may be the efficient outcome, right? Like, you can imagine a society in which, you know, everybody toils to provide luxury goods and services for a small handful of wealthy elite. And that may be the efficient outcome of what that market has provided. But all of us have sort of a visceral gut objection to that society, primarily because most of us wouldn't want to roll the dice and live in that society. So you can have efficient markets that are still undesirable to society, which I think are the primary examples that you've cited. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think that's right. Market-based systems may not be best for society. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I can prove that yet, but...
That could be what you get your PhD in.
I could keep coming back to it, so it may very well be.
Maybe you don't get a physics constant named after you, but you do get an economics principle named after you, the Polycus principle.
The Polycus heterodoxy of economics. Let me write that down to you. I'm gonna post that online. There'll be a website by the time this podcast gets posted.
I love it.
That's a joke. In summary, reason I don't like goods and services markets is they're not always efficient. And even if they are, efficient market isn't necessarily the best for society. People are not always able to choose what they want because of transaction costs, information asymmetry, et cetera. We're not always choosing what's best for us because we're emotional, irrational. Something I didn't even mention is a short-term decision-making bias versus what's optimal, which is also a human emotional thing and also a societal thing. And often we're selfish, but not always factoring in what's best for society. So while it may be efficient, it's not best for society. The fact that prices and production are supposed to adjust to aggregate demand, I mean, prices are sticky. Adjustments take years to actually make when we're talking about a company making strategic decisions to make more product. I mean, that's really not something that happens quickly, whereas things in the economy can change more quickly than they're able to adjust. And then the equilibrium may not be fair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in luck, as I've told you, but I do believe that where you are born into is a matter of luck. And like you said, if you were given two society options and one had more inequality and one had less, and you were randomly placed into one or the other world, which would you pick?
I know that's a very famous principle. I think I ran into it the first time through Paul Krugman's blog. I'll put it in the show notes, but it's that principle that if you had to live in a society and be randomly chosen, like your starting attributes of, you know, who your parents were, where you were born, all that stuff was randomly chosen, would you want to grow up in that society? And we should structure our society to meet that goal. I think it's a really it's a really helpful principle for doing social policy planning. You know what market I wouldn't want to be in right now?
Which one?
The market for selling Trump campaign signs to Minnesotans. Like in the last couple of weeks, we had sort of an explosion of campaign signs around the Twin Cities.
Uh-huh.
And I've actually been actively looking to see if I can find anyone who is brave enough to put a Trump sign on their lawn. And I drive around the Twin Cities a lot, so I would think I would get a good coverage of conservative areas, liberal areas, etc.
Uh-huh.
I have not seen a single Trump-Pence sign on any lawn anywhere. And I know Minneapolis is a very liberal city, but, you know, there's got to be somebody, right? There's got to be someone out there.
Why don't you offer a reward?
Maybe. This is a city, though, where the Republican running for Congress has purple lawn signs. They're not, like, brave enough to make red signs because that will identify them as Republicans. And so he goes with purple.
I did not know you guys were that liberally focused.
It is a very liberal city.
Are you saying that in the last month, the number of signs for Trump has gone down? Or you haven't even seen any?
I haven't seen any. I've seen an explosion of Clinton signs in the last couple of weeks, which is what piqued me. I'm like, oh, I guess it's, you know, it's the month before the election. Everyone's getting their guns out. Like, it's go time. But no Trump signs.
What is your assessment of the election outcome today?
I have a giant rock just sitting on my button that says hold election today, and I'm just going to leave it there. I could not be happier with where things currently stand.
Okay, but look, I've saw one of many polls, which are all inaccurate, that showed people's perceptions of Trump versus Clinton over time. And now there have been times where Clinton was way ahead and one time where it crossed and Trump was actually winning. And they go back and forth, they kind of split and then come back together again. But if you just draw lines of the overall trend, the distance between the two trend lines is converging.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really close now. And yes, better today, better to hold the election today than in a month for your desired outcome.
Oh, for sure.
But it might still be close.
I don't know. I'm getting pretty confident here. This is the happiest I've been throughout the campaign cycle.
I mean, is it because of the recent controversy?
It's a combination of Clinton's good performance in the first debate, and there haven't been any particular major scandals that have broken on Clinton's side, whereas it seems like Trump is stepping in it, you know, almost every day at this point, with the, you know, very major one with the transcripts from his conversation about his treatment of women being the most recent one that came out yesterday. And I just don't know how he's going to dodge all of these things, you know, between that, between his taxes, between his, you know, foundation being accused of breaking the law. Like, I just don't see how he's going to keep dodging these anymore.
But that's the problem with the voting populace, at least the liberal side, is you keep saying the same thing of, I don't see how he can get away with being like this. I don't see how he can get away with this style. All the way back in the primaries, I don't see how he can get away with this personality and becoming any sort of serious candidate. He became a serious candidate. I don't see how he can get away with doing that for the rest of his campaign and still doing well. And he's gotten more and more popular. If you're saying you don't see how he can win an election with these scandals, that is not enough to convince me he's not going to win. That just shows that you're still in denial. It's the same, no offense, but it's the same argument I have heard for a year. And it's the same thing I've been telling you, the reason I thought he would win the nomination. Because people don't see that the election is not about scandals.
I think that there is a subset of the populace that has made their decision.
Well, of course.
And I don't disagree with that. Like, I think that you're right, that there is no amount of scandal. Like, he literally could go walk up to someone on the streets of New York City, shoot them in the face, and they wouldn't care. They'd be like, that person deserved it, right? Like,
exactly.
I agree with you. I don't think that fraction of the population and the distribution of that population in the country leads to an Electoral College win for Donald Trump.
I think he may win.
I don't know. Do you have a button?
Actually, I have a lot of buttons that get pushed all the time.
It's true. Well, tune into the debate. I'll be excited to see how well he bobs and weaves at the questions.
I will try to wake up at 3 a.m. tonight to watch the debate.
Ooh, it'll be worth it. So thanks for listening to this episode of the Maximize This podcast. As always, we have our discussion pages at Reddit at reddit.com/r/maximizethis and also our Facebook page at facebook.com/maximizethis. Feel free to jump in, add your perspective ideas. Tell us why markets are great. Tell us why Donald Trump is going to win the presidency. Any ideas for future topics, we'd love to hear them.
And check out our website at www.maximizethis.fm for news, new episodes, and bonus features. And tell your friends about how much you love our show.
And please, if you can, go on to iTunes, leave us a rating and a review. It really helps our visibility in the podcast community, attracts new listeners to the show.
And as you would never hear Donald Trump say, don't let pretty good be the enemy of perfect. And I hope you can cut this really short.
I guarantee I will, because I only have 3 days to cut it. So I'm going to be like a butcher on this thing.